There we go, now it's recording.
Okay.
Sabrina George, New Comedy Radio, the South Bank, sorry, technical hitch. We've actually done some recording and found out we weren't, so we're going to start again.
Somewhere is recording, though.
Somewhere is recording. I'm interviewing Dolly Sen on the South Bank, who is a prolific novelist and writer and performer and filmmaker and all sorts of things. So I'm very sorry, Dolly, can we start again? How would you describe yourself?
How would I describe myself? Well, I'll say what I said before, really. I think that's the best way to do it. When I'm being serious, I say I'm a writer, filmmaker and performer. Sometimes I add professional mad person, because I am actually do make money out of my madness by BBC and ITV and Sky and radio saying we need to know what it's like to be able to talk about it. So I do actually make money so from talking about being mad, so that is being a professional mad person, isn't it? But I also, when I'm high, think recently I read about Salvador Dali, and he said, I don't know how the world copes in not being Salvador Dali. Sometimes I think, how does the world cope not being Dolly Sen, you know? Luckily for myself and the people around me, that doesn't last very long. It just lasts about 2 hours in a year, which is enough, because otherwise I would be in Broadmoor.
Yeah, you were saying last year you were trying to speak to God?
No, I was trying to find God. Because the reason I was trying to find God, I had a friend who was in hospital, and he's got an Irish Catholic doctor. And I said, my friend he's been in the system 40 years. And I said,
how many?
40 years.
40 years.
40 years. I mean, he was locked up for 40 years. Very institutionalised. I said, why don't you release him? He said, it's up to me. And this doctor was weird. Every time he talked, he used to rub his nipples. And I just, you are the kind of guardian of sanity. You know? Well, anyway, I said, only God will make me change my mind. So I said, I'll find God for you. So first of all, I thought he was in CCTV TV cameras, and I started in the hospital CCTV camera, just smashing it. And then I thought, no, I'm not going to find it that way. I just ask people, you know. So I ask people, and usually say, you want to speak to God? Pray. I said, yes, but I want to speak to God face to face, you know. I want to see if he has hair growing out of his ears, you know. Or if it's a she, or if it's an it, or if it's a duck-billed platypus. What does he look like? But I never did find him, actually.
Was it whilst you were looking for God in person?
Mm.
Did any part of you realise that you were being bonkers? Or were you completely absorbed in that particular passion at the time?
No, I believed it. You know, I really did believe it. I find it very difficult, even when I'm supposedly well, to think sane. You know, it just sends me to sleep, really. I don't know why.
So you've written, to just talk about your books, how many have you written?
15. And I have to cheat and say part of those 15 include two anthologies, which I've written before, but there are other people involved as well. And it's poetry, and it's short stories, and it's fiction, and it's non-fiction. And non-fiction is my kind of two autobiographies. One called The World is Full of Laughter, and the second one, the follow-up to that, is Am I Still Laughing? And that's where I found my feet in, you know, comedy writing. It's writing about my life.
And how old were you when you started writing and getting published?
I started to hear voices and see things when I was 14, so I dropped out of school. treated horrifically by social services and child psychiatry at the time, so I just dropped out of the world, basically. Yeah. Had no support whatsoever. So I got involved with drinking and drugs. But I was losing my friends one by one through suicidal drugs. And I didn't want to go that way, so I stopped drinking and taking drugs and needed something else to do. And I think I was reading a lot of them, kind of the mad writers in the 50s, you know, the Beats, like William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg. And you know, a lot of their writing was about, you know, madness. They all had been in, you know, in the psychiatric institution. So that inspired me to write, basically. I didn't get them published until I was in my late 20s. I didn't submit it anywhere for many, many years. It was just a personal kind of, you know, tool for my own journey, really.
And how did you take that step from writing just as a way of expressing yourself to yourself to actually taking the action to getting published?
Well, it was friends saying, you know, this is worthy of being published, you know, don't, you know, keep it to yourself. And also I've got a huge ego, thanks to my dad. So I was like, yeah, I would like to be famous. I don't really feel like that anymore, but that's when I started submitting it. But the way I got published, like, it wasn't through submitting my work to publishers, it just actually bumping into my publishers and, you know, at coffee mornings or, you know, like a supermarket. That's how I got published.
How do you bump into a publisher in the supermarket?
Well,
just looking for God, you found them.
No, I think I was looking for Weetabix or something. Well, I always read.
There's thousands of writers out there trying to find a publisher. You go and get one by buying Weetabix.
No, it was because I read when I'm in the queue. Whenever I'm waiting for something, I read. And the person behind me was what are you reading? And I can't remember what I was reading at the time. And then we were just talking about our favourite writers. And then he said, oh, he's a publisher. He said, really? Are you a publisher? I'm a writer. He said, oh, email me some of your stuff. So that's how I got my my memoir. He liked what I wrote and he said, I'm going to commission you to write your memoir. So that's how that came about. I had put off that book, my memoir. I wanted to write it, but I put it off because I thought it would just be too painful. Because I grew up in a very, very abusive family. My father almost killed me twice. I mean, I was strangled to the point of unconsciousness twice. And beaten quite severely. So really a horrific childhood. So I thought, people don't want to hear about this, so I thought I'll say my writing is bittersweet, but you need the sweetness to kind of to give them, even, you know, to kind of counteract the bitterness, but also to give it a bit more kind of weight as well.
And your father was a stand-up comic.
He started off as a musician, and then from being a musician, he became an actor, and then he wanted to be a comic. I can't say he was one, really. I mean, he did stuff like appear on Barry Moore's Saturday Evening Show and stuff like that. But I don't think he was very successful. You know, I remember going to a couple of his gigs and nobody laughing at his stuff. And he said, oh, you people are so stupid. You know, this is beneath me. And he believed that kind of stuff, even though it wasn't funny. And if he couldn't get a laugh, he would take off his socks and shoes and cut his toenails.
Great, okay. And he wasn't the mad one.
He wasn't the mad. No, he actually is. He is also certifiably mad. We've both been in the Maudsley Hospital, let's put it that way.
Not at the same time.
Not at the same time.
And your father's Asian?
He's half Indian, half Nepalese. Yes. Brought up in India and Pakistan, and then moved here in the late 50s.
And so his comedic bent did or did not inform your comedy?
Without my dad, I wouldn't have become a comedian, but not because I wanted to be like him, or he didn't inspire me. He was just the thing that made me laugh. That's how he's informed.
So you were laughing at him, rather than with him.
At him. So that's how it's informed my comedy. But I mean, it did stop me from wanting to do that, because I didn't want to be like my dad, you know.
And when did comedy start coming into your writing?
It came when I was writing about my life. Just like I said before, you can give people, you know, the truth of your life, but you know it's both dark and light. You know, you can't talk about one without the other. And I just find it easier to write. Just find it easier to write, kind of utilising both the dark and the light side of, you know.
Tell us a story about Spielberg again.
All right.
We missed that, yeah.
All right. When I was about 10, 11, with a bunch of, I think, 100 other Asian kids, we were used for the film Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And I was on the film for about 2 weeks. And it was the second director was filming us. And then Steven Spielberg came on set. And he was, this is my ego going to come into play again. He was just standing there looking at me. I thought, wow. I elbowed my sister who was with me. Steven Spielberg's looking at me. Maybe he's going to choose me for his next film, you know. I'm going to be a star. And then he came, he talked to somebody else, and then this other person came up to me and said, Dolly, can you come outside? We can't use you, I'm afraid. He said, why not? He said, I know you are 10, but you don't look 10. You're a head taller than everyone else, and you have breasts. And I was just totally devastated, you know. So I left the film set and sat outside on the wall, and about 10 minutes later I was joined by a boy who was very overweight and who also had tits. He also had 6 toes on one foot, but I don't think they dismissed him because of that. Poor guy. He used to be sick all the time because they used to be picked up from central London to go to the studio. I can't remember which one. Was it Elstree or the other one?
Pinewood,
yeah. And he used to be sick every time on the coach. I wonder where he is now. Anyway, he joined me and he was crying. I tried to cheer him up. I said, don't worry. Don't take it personally, even though I had taken it personally, you know. Our tits are just too big for Steven Spielberg. Bastard. But it's a good talking point, saying, I was sacked by Steven Spielberg.
From being an extra in a movie that required lots and lots of children that had been in for 2 weeks. I know I was an extra in a film and I slept in the background and nobody noticed for 2 weeks. I was a chuffed as bits. Stupid job imaginable. So, because you were talking before about this thing, waking up, or when you've woken up, can you just explain that a bit?
Being mad meant being in hell for a very long time. I mean, it's just, you know, very, very negative, dark place to be, and absolutely no light. I was just constantly depressed and constantly suicidal. I mean, it was, you know, just little things like going to my local post office and a guy saying, why are you in vengeance? And so I've got mental health issues. Oh, you know, Hitler had the right idea about people like you, and knowing that he was a person in the wrong, but I could complain because his word would be taken over mine just for the fact that I have got mental health issues, you know. And like going to a work program by the DSS and saying, I wanted to be a writer. Don't be silly, you know. You can't be a writer. Work in Marks and Spencer's. That's what you can do. That apart from just the internal pain, the world was, you know, it was just being very discriminatory towards me. That depressed me. But when I hit about 30, I think a lot of people, when they hit 30, just kind of do wake up a little bit. Maybe they don't, or they go, oh my God, what have I done with my life? But then I should realise that I should be a bit, you know, not ashamed to be mad. And, you know, in fact, have some pride in it, because, you know, I'm in good company. Look at the, you know, look at the near Tate Modern, you know, most of it is done by people who are absolutely bonkers. And in fact, if you took all the mad painters away and all the mad writers away, you would just have an Argos catalogue or Catherine Cookson and Geoffrey Archer's in your library. So, so you know, I'm in good company, so that kind of helped, you know. And also just viewing things not negatively, just, you know, being a bit more positive.
And is that when your writing changed?
It changed. I mean, yeah. I mean, my stuff before then would have been good material for people like Morrissey and Velvet Underground and Sylvia Plath. It was very, very dark and miserable, and I'm glad I've thrown most of that stuff away. But, so yeah, it's also been self-absorbed as well.
And do you think that's where the comedy came from? Was suddenly thinking, not positively isn't the right word, but seeing life in a different way?
Yeah, seeing life in a different way.
Because you were seeing it very differently before, but in another different way.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's just... And also, by that point, who are sane people to talk, you know? You know, just look at the world as it is. I mean, look at... People work, you know, for 40, 50 years, and in a job most people, you know, most people hate, you know, with mortgages, and I think that's not life, really. It's just... So I would just say, what, you know, same people, who are you to talk? Look at the world they create. It's very mercenary and it's money orientated and status orientated, you know. And then when I started to make fun of same people, that's really, you know, when life became enjoyable, really.
Really good. Well, because this is something that, again, I'm going to use a stereotype because it's easier, but... I have noticed, being in central London, working on the comedy field, because you get so many people from all over the world, that there's a particular genre of comic from North America that loves using the term retard, spastic, frequently and often in their comedy, and they are technically what we would call sane people. Mm. And I was wondering, what's your take on that?
My take on that is they're probably using those terms... in a kind of nasty way, really. Well, I'm assuming they are using it in a kind of nasty way.
Well, I've heard, yes.
Yes, so I think they're idiots, then. And I think you can talk about that experience unless you've gone through it, really. I mean, you know, if a white person starts talking about Indian stereotypes, it sits uncomfortably. But it's different when an Indian person does it, really. I think they should show a bit more imagination. Those people who kind of, you know, use the word retard and spat.
Yeah, well, what's interesting in British audiences, it's obviously not the case in North American audiences, is British audiences, well, certainly in London, again, I can't talk the whole of Britain as if it's perfect, but a British audience, a London audience, generally... holds back, and whether it's because of training that they've just got, oh, we're uncomfortable with that, or whether they genuinely don't find it funny, I don't know, but they don't tend to respond, and the North Americans then have to change, if they're intelligent, they change their set and drop it, but they often don't know why they're changing, they're just going, that doesn't work.
Do you think that if that same show they had seen be played in the kind of privacy in their own home, would they, it kind of...
I don't know.
No.
I don't know. I think there are some audience members who might find that funny. I mean, there's Roy Chubby Brown makes fortunes out of being the most racist, bigoted sexist person. I mean, he is funny, but sometimes you're sitting there going, this isn't right.
Well, there are other people like Jim Davison who are not funny ever.
But he ain't working anymore.
Yeah, no. But I did remember reading him about, oh, I can't perform, there are people in wheelchairs in front of me and in the front row, I can't do it. And I thought, yes! Not for the reason that he's been a bigot, it's we can stop him from performing. If we went to every one of his shows and just put up people in wheelchairs, it would stop him. So I thought, you know, think like that and, you know, use their own stupidity against them.
So I went to a lovely gig last year in Edinburgh with this Irish comic, and he was doing a city venue, you know, city-funded venue, and it was fairly full, and he had a signer with him for deaf people. And he went on stage and he said, are there any deaf people in the audience? And she signed it, and not a single person put their hand up. And he said, you know, once a month it was under civic rules that they had to have a signer doing a show. And it was hysterically funny because this poor woman was completely superfluous to requirements, but it was brilliant because he worked it into the show, and she was fabulous, and she worked into it very well, but she was signing for nobody. She became a performer in her own right.
That's
in a way,
cool.
which is kind of wonderful. But I was thinking, that's another element I wanted to ask you about, is, like, you know, in the area of performance, in the area of any creative art, should we be, like, pushing the normal acceptance further by having signers on, by having wheelchair access, by having, you know, an allocated space for people who are have mental health issues or physical health issues?
I think, you know, venues need to be accessible, but I mean, with regards to kind of just I don't think it would work if you did it that way. I think what you do need to is to promote it in the right way, because I think there would have been deaf people there if it had been promoted properly. Because, you know, my mother is deaf, so the kind of deaf community is hungry, really ravenous for, you know, performative stuff, you know. So I think in that way it needs to be addressed, it needs to be promoted properly. But
because in some areas of the world, in some communities, people with mental and physical health issues are just literally hidden in the back room.
I mean, we've got a connection, the organisation I worked with, we've got a connection with the Young Vic.
Which is a theatre company.
Young Vic Theatre Company. And they very proudly put us in the front. I mean, we're very visibly mad people, which is good, because the people seen behind us don't get up to move until we get up to, you know, to leave the building, which is really...
And what's this group that you're part of?
It's Creative Roots. We're a 100% Mad Blade organisation. In fact, we might even test people before they join us, because we have found the same people wanted to join the class, you know. And we've got a really cool application form. How long have you been mad? When the Maudsley Hospital read that, you can't say that, you know. It's politically incorrect. Well, come on, you with... So,
and is that how you got into writing?
No.
How did you get into writing?
I was a writer before I came to Creative Roots. In fact, that's how they knew about me. When it started up, they started headhunting quite a lot of creative, mad people that were on the, you know, either performing or writing, and that's how it began, basically. So, I had my book published by Chipmunker, my memoir. That's how the person who was setting up Creative Roots knew of me. So that's how I got it on board. The writing of it came before me joining Creative Roots.
And then you started editing their newsletter?
I started editing their newsletter. And that's where the writing had to be just totally comedic. I mean, now I've got a serious problem when I talk about personal experiences. And I'm kind of attacking the system. But there are also kind of like little... I mean, in the next newsletter, I'm doing money off vouchers for the mad. So 10% for people who have delusions, 10% off your next crucifixion. for Depressive's 10% off your next Morrissey album, you know, if you've just been injected up the arse, one cushion per token, per butchy. And just to, you know, just to bring light to what seems to be expected to be a very negative, miserable experience.
And how does the readership respond to this?
Well, we the last newsletter, when we also have a dog that's an agony aunt, which is really, I'm the agony aunt, but the dog's picture is in the newsletter. And we just get, you know, hate mail, you know, how dare you make fun of mad people. We are the people who write this newsletter are mad people. We're run by mad people. It's just, I think, listen, you know, how dare you, because the people that, you know, people have committed suicide over this. I said, well, maybe people commit suicide because they feel alone, alienated, and having humour is a way to connect with the world again, you know. And it's a difficult one. I mean, I do get low and I do get suicidal at times, but
you find the funny side in that?
No, I do not, really.